This edition of the Recap was first broadcast on the 7th of November 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello, I'm Tom Edwards, and welcome to The Recap, bringing you highlights from the past week's live news and analysis programmes, broadcast right here on Monocle 24. Over the next half hour, we'll bring you some of the very best interviews and reports from The Globalist, The Briefing, Midori House and The Monocle Daily. Coming up...
So the latest snippet is that the foreign minister criticised Iran for regional meddling. And Rouhani, Iran's president, is quoted as saying some young man was very rude in front of his elders. So the foreign minister is actually in his 50s.
Almost as soon as they began, Iran threatened to leave the Syrian peace talks. We'll find out how much they're really needed around the negotiating table. And...
Think yourself back to when you were 6 or 7 years old and you were in the kindergarten and you had best friends and suddenly they all went sour and you wouldn't talk to them for ages and ages and ages, and then you had a big kiss and you made up. Asian leaders behave in exactly that way, and we are in the middle of an Asian love-in.
South Korea's President Park Geun-hye and Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe held their first formal bilateral talks, pledging to resolve disputes over wartime history and to counter the nuclear threat from North Korea this week. Our experts discuss the historic meeting. Also, change ahead at The Grey Lady as the publisher of The New York Times announces he'll be handing on the baton to a younger member of his family. We'll take a look at what lies ahead for this staple of the American media. And later in the programme, Amazon opens a physical extension of its website. A bookshop, no less. All that and much, much more coming up in the next half hour right here on The Recap with me, Tom Edwards. The conflict in Syria is often cited as a proxy battle between the area's biggest regional rivals, Shiite Iran backing Assad and Sunni Saudi Arabia supporting the anti-government forces. But now it seems the peace process over the Syrian conflict is becoming a battleground too. After last Friday's meeting in Vienna, at which both nations sat around the table, Iran quickly announced an intention to eventually walk away because Saudi Arabia was being negative. Is this the start of a return to bad-tempered business as usual? Monocle's Dominic Reynolds and Emma Nelson spoke to Ramita Navai, foreign affairs journalist and author of City of Lies, Love, Sex, Death and the Search for Truth in Tehran on Monday's edition of the Monocle Daily.
They've been bitching about each other from the very beginning. And actually, it's that their bitching has been extraordinary as well. And I've loved the little snippet. So the latest snippet is that the foreign minister criticised Iran for regional meddling. And Rouhani, Iran's president, is quoted as saying some young man was very rude in front of his elders. So the foreign minister is actually in his 50s, but I guess much younger than the last foreign minister, who was in his 70s. And the Saudi foreign minister actually appears to be quite forgiving, because it was released a few years ago that there was a plot to kill him by the Iranians, which of course is denied by the Iranians. But if this is true, it's quite forgiving of him, to say the least. This is the latest, just the usual snide remarks about each other's involvements and fingers in the pie in the Middle East. To what extent is this being thrashed out? What is being thrashed out? Well, the fact that all of these powers have come together and they've agreed on some kind of political process, first of all, tells you how important it is to have Iran at the table. The power that they wield within Syria. Obama phoned Saudi and pretty much pleaded with Saudi to come to the table and join. Don't forget that it wasn't so long ago that Iran was not invited to these peace talks. The last peace talks, Iran was barred. But the nuclear negotiations have paved the way for Iran. Iran is coming in from the cold, and the West realizes that no resolution can be agreed on in Syria regarding the war without Iran, in Iran's involvement. I think the timing of these talks is really interesting. It comes a month after Russia started their airstrikes. And when Russia started their airstrikes, for the first time, favor in the war has really tipped to Assad's side. He's really got the upper hand now. And Russia's involvement as well also pits Russia and Iran against the US. So, all round, interesting things are happening.
Given the international attention on that table, do you think Iran would actually leave these talks at this point? Is this a bluff, this threat?
No, it's not a bluff. With Iran, you never know. So with Iran, there are always internal politics involved. So another reason that Iran could step away is because Iran is under pressure. The reformists, so-called reformists, so this government, Rouhani's government, is under pressure from the hardliners. The hardliners do not like Iran sitting at a table with the Americans and the Saudis. And not so long ago, the supreme leader of Iran said, "We will not negotiate and we will not participate in any talks with the US, and look what's happening now." And the hardliners have been quite vocal about this in the Iranian media, and they've been quite vocal against these peace talks. They do not like the fact that a political process has already been agreed upon, the ceasefire, establishing a new governing body. The hardliners can't bear that.
So what does Iran want then to stay at the table?
Not so long ago, Iran was saying there is no way that we will accept Syria without Assad. They've made concessions, as have the Americans. A while ago, America was saying, you know, Assad must go immediately. So it seems that they're kind of both moving towards each other. And they've both agreed tentatively, although, of course, they do keep changing their minds about this as well, on a period of transition. So the Iranian Deputy Foreign Minister not so long ago said, listen, actually, no, we don't insist on Assad staying. So what I see happening is similar to what happened in Iraq with Maliki. You know, Maliki was causing an absolute mess. Everybody needed him out. But it was inconceivable that Maliki would be replaced by somebody who wasn't approved by Iran. I think the same will happen in Syria.
That was Foreign Affairs journalist Ramita Navai speaking to Monocle's Dom Reynolds and Emma Nelson on Monday's Monocle Daily. You're listening to The Recap on Monocle 24. South Korea's President Park Geun-hye and Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe held their first formal bilateral talks on Monday since both leaders took office. The meeting is a diplomatic breakthrough for Abe, who has sought talks with Park to improve relations in the face of an increasingly assertive China. The Park-Abe meeting comes after a summit of South Korean, Japanese and Chinese leaders last Sunday, where they agreed to restore what had been an annual forum to work towards greater regional cooperation. Monocle's executive editor Steve Bloomfield was joined to talk about it by Peter Fleming, Professor of Business and Society at Cass Business School and author of the book The Mythology of Work, and John Everard, the UK's former ambassador to Uruguay, Belarus and North Korea, on Monday's Midori House.
At last, they're talking again. A basic sort of primer for Asian politics, for anybody who's not really familiar with it. Think yourself back to when you were 6 or 7 years old and you were in the kindergarten and you had best friends and suddenly they all went sour and you wouldn't talk to them for ages and ages and ages, and then you had a big kiss and you made up. Asian leaders behave in exactly that way, and we are in the middle of an Asian love-in. That the Chinese, who have been saying very, very nasty things about the Japanese, and the South Koreans, who have been accusing the Japanese of not being sufficiently apologetic for the comfort women of the Second World War, all of a sudden, big handshakes, they've worked out some kind of modus vivendi, and they have had quite a productive meeting. The world breathes a huge sigh of relief. Notice the choreography, that it all happened in Seoul, in South Korea. Li Keqiang, the Premier of China, comes first to Seoul. So he and President Park Geun-hye have a bilateral. They're joined by Abe, Prime Minister Abe of Japan, for a day, and then the Chinese go, leaving the Japanese and the South Koreans together. So it's what you call variable geometry. You get not only a three-way summit out of the deal, you get two nice, spicy bilaterals where probably quite a lot of real business was done. This is a rare outbreak of common sense, and yes, I hope it continues. I hope it will be encouraged.
Peter, they have a lot to talk about, obviously, not just about matters of the past, and we might come on to that in a moment, but also issues of trade and issues to do with security within the region right now. What do you think is likely to be the result of these meetings, sort of further down the line?
Well, China has been very involved in the bilateral discussions, and China's got a big stake in all of this as well, as they're building their islands as we speak. So what is going to be quite important, I think, is sorting out the territory disputes that have not been sorted out, and particularly the islands in the south of Japan. And I guess that would be something that would be very important for taking this step forward even in a more positive direction. And of course, by the way, South Korean pop music is the most popular in Japan, so I think think that's probably at the heart of all of this.
That certainly helps. But it is interesting, John, that Japan and South Korea, they're two democracies, they're two capitalist societies. They have these soft power links, as Peter's just alluded to there, with pop music and soap operas that go both ways. And yet, their inability to be friendly to each other at a governmental level is astonishing. It was as if Britain and Germany still wouldn't talk to each other right now.
Well, no, not quite. They go through phases of having bad relations. Remember, not so long ago, they were co-hosting a World Cup.
Not very happily.
Okay, but they were doing it. I mean, can you imagine sort of two countries in Europe trying that and getting away with it? Anyway, they one or another, they did actually pull it off. The problem, as so often in Asia, is the past, different perceptions of history, and the way in particular that the Japanese Imperial Army behaved during the period of Japanese supremacy, which ended in 1945. It's clear that some kind of deal has been done behind the scenes between Prime Minister Abe and President Park Geun-hye to enable the handshake that we saw just a few hours ago. And it almost certainly involves a form of words around the comfort women, as they're called, the many Koreans who were forced into sexual slavery to satiate the cravings of Japanese soldiers. The Koreans remain very angry about this. The Japanese on their side feel that every time they offer what they think is a sufficient apology, the Koreans move the goalposts and demand more and more and more again. So let's hope that this issue is finally put to rest in a way that keeps everybody happy.
That was a highlight from Monday's edition of Midori House. You're listening to The Recap on Monocle 24. Time now for a highlight from Thursday's edition of The Globalist. On Wednesday, the British government welcomed Egypt's President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi for a three-day visit to promote security cooperation and trade links. But while Egypt's human rights record has been heavily criticised in the UK, with Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn even saying that Britain's invitation of President Sisi threatens Britain's national security, discussions of human rights were not on the agenda. So should the UK follow the example of Chinese President Xi Jinping's visit last month and largely sweep these issues under the red carpet? Or should it put dissidents' liberty front and centre during state visits and risk upsetting an important trade partner? On Thursday's Globalist, Peter Cardwell spoke to Adele Darwish, political editor at Middle East News, and Monocle's contributor Ruth Michelson on the line from Cairo.
Essentially, what has happened since 2013 is that the government has systematically gone through various ways that people could gather or express dissent and either surveys them or controls them very heavily. The entrances to Tahrir Square have these very large metal gates on with the Egyptian flag painted on, and the gates are there to lock down the square so that people can't get in there and protest. There have been a huge range of policies surveying people's online behaviours so that if you post lots of things on Facebook talking about, you know, was a fondness for the Muslim Brotherhood or something else, or as, you know, as we saw the Facebook user that posted that satirical photo of Sisi, that can lead to pushback in itself. So it's really been that there's been a systematic effort to shut down and to control ways in which people can express their dissent, and more importantly, in which people can express their dissatisfaction in a way that allows them to congregate with other people and to act on it.
Adele Darwish here in London. I wonder whether David Cameron will feel the pressure or feel obligated to talk about human rights here, or whether those vital trade links, other issues such as Libya and of course the security crisis, will dominate.
Yes, security has always been on the agenda, as I think it was number two on the agenda. But probably now it'd be a jump into number one, and I think they will try to soften the blow a bit. The British traditional way going on now for decades is different from the American megaphone diplomacy, which is shouting at people. During the Chinese president visit here, I was in programs discussing this issue as well. And I think the conclusion is if you wag your finger at people and foreign countries and so on, they immediately get their back up. And they said, well, we're not going to cooperate with you. Why should we? Well, you're old kind of colonial past would come and so on. But the behind closed door diplomacy, it achieved better results. Last week, when the Foreign Secretary Philip Hammond went to Saudi Arabia with quiet diplomacy over dinner with no cameras, with nobody there, he managed to secure the release of a British prisoner there, and he helped reduce sentences for Saudi national and so on. And I think this has been the Foreign Office and the British way. So probably we'll, towards sort of the end of the agenda or the meeting or over lunch when no one else in the room.
Yes, doing it in a subtle way.
A very subtle way. So Mr. Cameron probably will bring it up with Mr. Sisi. But these issues are more sort of the middle-class Guardian readers, 300,000 people in Britain, while the majority of people wanted to know how much trade the foreign visitor is going to bring here. I mean, Britain is the largest actually foreign investment with about sort of over 2 billion every year. But I think Whitehall have an agenda which includes human rights, but as I said, they put it in a very quiet way when only two officials in the meeting, not in a large meeting.
That was Peter Cardwell speaking to Adele Darwish, political editor at Middle East News, and Monocle's contributor Ruth Michelson in Cairo on Thursday's Globalist. Up next, all the news that's fit to print. It will keep the old motto, but who will be the new publisher of the New York Times?
Travel in comfort with the help of the Monocle Shop. It's the place to select the best bags, passport wallets, travel guides, and, of course, the latest issue of the magazine to entertain you on your lounger. We have a great lineup of special collaboration bags with Porter in Japan, including the new Overnighter bag, ideal for a city weekend trip. And then there's the limited edition Remova multi-wheel, made from lightweight polycarbonate in a special Monocle edition. Visit our stores in London, New York, Toronto, Singapore, Tokyo, and Hong Kong, or shop online at monocle.com. Be the one turning heads at the luggage carousel.
You're listening to The Recap, a look back at our coverage of the week gone by in live news shows broadcast here on Monocle 24. I'm Tom Edwards. Since 1896, five generations of the Ochs-Sulzberger family have been in control of the New York Times. Today, Arthur Sulzberger Jr. is both publisher and current chairman, but during an annual address on Monday, he announced that the company intended to name a deputy publisher as the first step in choosing his successor. On Tuesday's Globalist, Monocle's Georgina Godwin spoke to the journalist Michael Goldfarb all about it.
It's a family-owned enterprise, but the family couldn't possibly keep it going on its own. So there's two classes of shares. And this is really critical. The family holds the A-class shares. They're the ones who really run the show, but periodically they go to their other shareholders and ask for money. Mm-hmm. Most recently, Carlos Slim, the telecoms billionaire from Mexico City, floated them a massive loan to get them through the first decade of this new and changing millennium, especially changing for journalism businesses. And they paid back the loan early, in fact. But this is a family enterprise going back to 1896. And the competition will be amongst members of the family. Believe me, there's no HR firm in New York doing a big search for who will be the next publisher of the New York Times. It's discussed over dinner, I think.
But as you say, there are two tiers here. And might activist shareholders make trouble during the transition? Because, of course, Sulzberger Jr. hasn't always been popular with them.
No, he hasn't. And I think that this announcement, I mean, which in some ways, I mean, it's like a royal family, isn't it? I mean, it would be very interesting if someday Her Majesty the Queen were to say, we're going to have a competition between Prince Charles and Prince William to see who becomes the next king. No, it's not quite like that. The activist shareholders do from time to time get really fed up with the current publisher, Arthur Sulzberger. And I think that his announcement that we're taking a 2-year process and I'll appoint a deputy publisher so you will know who will replace me, is a way, a kind of internal beauty contest, as well as a way of saying, I'm in control of this business, and we're not going to surprise you, our big other Class B shareholders, with someone you can't handle. You will know in advance who's going to take over the business from me. In all likelihood, it will be his son, A.G. Sulzberger, who I think is the third of that name. And instead of being called Junior or the third, he's being called A.G. That's how we'll refer to him in the rest of this interview.
Right. So A.G. and the others, I believe there are six members of the family currently working in the business. As you say, chosen over dinner, but actually it's a little bit more formal than that. I think there's a committee, isn't there?
Yes, there's a committee, and many are descended through the female line of Iphigenia Oak Sulzberger. She was not allowed to take over the paper when it was her generation's turn, but her children have done very well, and then they're the direct line of descent from the Arthur Sulzbergers. And they're distributed evenly. One of the likely candidates came up through an MBA program at Harvard and is strictly on the business side. A.G. Sulzberger has been a reporter and an editor around the newsroom, so he's on the journalism side, as well as he is the author of the Time strategy paper for online and growth in new media. And I think that that's the important thing to talk about, because the real challenge to the New York Times is it has become, not by choice, I have to emphasize this, kind of a quasi-official institution of journalism. It is the sine qua non. No newspaper has a newsroom staff this size, nor is the definitive newspaper of record. I mean, it's not a competition. It has earned this over a century and a half. But now, how do you deal with this in an online world? How do you deal with it where the expense of printing a daily paper for New York City, which is where most of their print circulation is, how do you deal with that in a world where you've got to build 30, 40, 50 million regular users online?
Well, Sulzberger, he's announced a new six-point plan for the paper. Digital strategy is absolutely at the heart of that. I think the goal is to double its digital revenue from $400 million a year to $800. That's by 2020. Also on the agenda, I think, expanding the international readership, as you say, that's got to be very important. Video, they're looking at expanding in that direction. Reimagining print, I think he says.
Yes, I mean, one of the interesting things, now it's not uncommon for them to have a very nice, I have to say, video package in the middle of the homepage front every day of the week, and really very highly produced. But how do you pay for that? Is that done by Time staffers, or do you go out and something they don't like to do, which is give a production company $50,000, $100,000, whatever, to make this, who has the editorial control? These are all internal discussions at the time, which is the most tightly held thing. I mean, I've written a few articles for them. The editing process is shocking to me. You know, I freelance for a lot of British newspapers. I send in my copy. Unless there's something absolutely egregious, my copy runs as I've written it. You send in to the New York Times, it's like you're being given a viva for your PhD at Oxford. Come on, guys. You know, newspapers are about fast. They're about speed.
Yeah.
And they haven't quite adjusted yet to the speed of online and our demand for it and their internal process, which prizes accuracy and grayness, which is why it's called the Gray Lady, over the kind of flair that we've come to like. So the Times has to change on the editorial side as much as the business side to get the next generation of people to consume their news product.
That was Monocle's Georgina Godwin speaking to the journalist Michael Goldfarb on Tuesday's edition of The Globalist. You're listening to The Recap here on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards. We've just been discussing the future of a well-loved paper, but another story emerged in print this week as Amazon, that behemoth of online retail, opened a bricks-and-mortar bookshop in Seattle. In a move described as a physical extension of its business, the store will stock 5,000 of the most popular books from Amazon.com, and the prices will be the same as those displayed on the website. On Wednesday's briefing, Monocle's Marco Sippi was joined by Charmaine Lovegrove, co-founder of Dialogue Scouting, to discuss it in more detail.
I was really annoyed when I first heard about this. I've been a bookseller since I was 16. I've worked in numerous bookshops like Foyles and the London Review of Books. I've actually owned my own bookshop in Berlin. Amazon had a 20-year campaign to totally disrupt bookselling and take away our physical bookshops from countries that had took away the net book agreement. The net book agreement means that all prices of the book should be the same, and so to not have that meant you could charge any price for a book. And I feel that Amazon destabilized the bookselling community by rampantly ensuring that the prices were low, which meant authors couldn't get paid, that publishers couldn't publish the books that they wanted. And now, 20 years later, they're saying, actually, we were wrong. We really want to have a physical bookshop.
Do you think this is their way of saying that they were wrong? Or do you see any other logic to launching a bookshop now?
Well, maybe it was part of their huge strategy, and we as lovers of books and as publishers and as retailers didn't necessarily see the fact that this was maybe in their plan all along to completely disrupt and destroy bookselling internationally. so that then they could have a place within bookselling history and being one of the only big brand bookshops. You know, there is no Borders anymore, for example. But maybe that was part of their strategy all along, and we were too busy reading and to take notice of the wider business plan that they may have had.
Previous time when we talked about Amazon here on Monocle 24 was when British book retailer Waterstones stopped selling Kindles in stores due to poor sales. Do you see some kind of a connection over here or a pattern?
Well, you know, I think the big thing is that an e-reader is not the same as an e-book. And we saw a trend with all digital retailers such as John Lewis, for example. You know, they are no longer selling as many e-readers as they had done previously. So it makes sense that Waterstones are looking at that. But e-books are definitely still on trend. I think that people are still reading, and I'm happy about that. I wish they wouldn't read necessarily on a Kindle and look at other devices, but I'm happy that people are reading on whatever format they want to. But I do feel that this disruption has been kind of catastrophic for booksellers all over the world.
So what Amazon says is that they're using their 20 years of online bookselling experience to build a store that integrates the benefits of offline and online bookshopping. What does that mean? And what do they actually have in the shop?
You know, the thing is, what's really great about bookshops is the local community and the knowledge of local booksellers within that local community. So it's great that Amazon have all of this algorithm to tell you what their online customers are buying and, you know, what books they've looked at, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, those aren't localized, and local people want local bookshops that can really, really show them a way into culture that is relevant to them. And we're seeing in book publishing, we're seeing a trend from this year's Frankfurt, for example, that there's a lot more localized stories. And so I felt for a while, and I've said on this program before, that it's no longer just about the global look. And I think Monocle really understands that. It's about the localized look. So it's about looking at the world from a localized perspective and then moving outwards. And I think great that they have all of this algorithm and all of this information, but ultimately, is that really going to serve the individual customer of those particular stores?
And at the same time, what they do is to sell only books that have been rated the best. Do you think that's going to just make the selection not as exciting?
Totally. I mean, you know, when you look at countries like Germany, or if you look at Scandinavia and you look at how many books that they have in translation, for example, but in English speaking countries, it's only, let's say, 5% of books are translation. Are those books going to be highly rated? Is literary fiction going to be highly rated as high as YA or erotica, for example? You know, but people that are buying books on Amazon are not necessarily the same type of people that are buying books in bookshop, because they're looking for a different cultural outlook. And that would be my biggest concern, that there wouldn't be enough of a range of books to engage different types of readers. On the really positive note, then yeah, I think that the great thing about it is that it will enhance people's understanding of the importance of other bookshops that are still going, and hopefully more bookshops will, from different retailers, will open up. And I also think it will encourage publishers to look at the physical book again and to make sure that the cover, the quality of the physical book and the paper is to our expectations.
That was Monocle's Marco Sippi with a regular Monocle 24 guest, Charmaine Lovegrove, co-founder of Dialogue Scouting, having a chat on Wednesday's edition of The Briefing. Well, that's all we've got time for on this week's episode of The Recap. The show was produced by Tom Hall and Weidong Lin. Join us again next week to hear some of the very best of our live news shows from here on the station. But for now, from me, Tom Edwards, thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.